Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last week, we were talking about the 18th century developments, first with rivers, and then we moved into canals. And the point about today is we're continuing with canals because it was not some short-term burst followed by, as it were, a period of consolidation or stasis, which had been, I think it's fair to say, the earlier experience of canals in English history. Instead of which, what one has is the combination of many canals that perform important local functions, many that perform important regional functions, and also the creation of what in effect is a national system. And I've got here a few examples which I want to give you, selected to indicate that sort of argument. For example, when the Shropshire Union Canal was extended, it was able to take timber from Montgomeryshire into the Midlands. What that did was bring a lot of wealth into a part of Wales which was very poor at that period, and in particular into a part of Wales which was not benefiting from the expansion of coal and iron production in South Wales. Or from the 1790s, the Grand Junction Canal provided a link between the Thames at Brentford and the Midlands, which eliminated the need for a long river journey to Oxford in order to join the earlier Oxford Canal. You might almost think of it as an example of the parallel between the M1 and the M40 as routes between London and the West Midlands in the late 20th century, paralleling the routes between the Grand Junction Canal and, on the other hand, the Thames and the Oxford Canal. Or Bath Stone. Bath Stone was moved east along the Kennet and Avon Canal, being used for churches as far as Hungerford, which, as those of you who visited Hungerford will know, it has a handsome church, as well as actually some interesting antiques markets and some good restaurants. It's one of those towns in southern England which people tend to ignore, but actually offers a lot to the visitor. As with many canals, this was an instance of the linkage of rivers and canals. Improvements to the two rivers, the Kennet and the Avon, in the 1720s, being followed by the canal built between 1794 and 1810, with the completion of the Cainhill Docks at Devizes, which is a still impressive flight of 29 locks. Now, you know, that was, by any standard, a major engineering achievement. In 1788, George III, who was very interested in modern technology, he visited, for example, the carpet works at Axminster, visited the Sapperton Tunnel, through which the Thames Severn Canal runs, and, you know, it was being built at the time. And celebration of new links, new canal links, emphasises the liberating nature of transport for ordinary people. So this celebration included engravings, poems, and other works, including skits on hymns. So there was one, "Your patriots I straight will straight inspire and touch them with commercial fire," which was all about canal buildings. John Watson, a Yorkshire curate, in his 1759 verses on the navigation of the River Calder, published in the Union Journal or Halifax Advertiser of that year, had Neptune, the god of the sea, address a Briton in terms which clearly linked the commercial activity of improved navigation, internal navigation, to patriotism. Or, for example, J.F.'s swan song on obtaining the Birmingham and Worcester Canal Bill. You can just think about parliamentary legislation attracting songs like that, which was printed in the Birmingham and Stafford Chronicle of the 4th of August 1791, urged that the digging begin. Not centred on London, canals were important in developing intra-regional links, especially between the West Midlands and Lancashire, and for cutting transport costs within Britain. And thanks to the extent of British canal construction, industries benefited from cheaper transport costs and more reliable links than their French counterparts. There were canals in France, but it was a much less comprehensive network. And in Britain, the potential for regional specialisation increased because regions that could produce goods cheaply were now better able to compete in areas with higher cost local production. And this was to be crucial to economic development because division of labour was only effective with a high volume of production, and this required a large market. However, it'd be foolish to neglect the limitations of the canal system in the period. And that's something I really ought to emphasize, because whenever we're talking about transport, and I hope I did this adequately in the discussions we had about railways and about roads, there is this tendency, particularly you'll see it in, the kind of history books you read on airport, in airport bookstalls or in WH Smith's or on the television programs they put on the BBC. They tend to take a very, uniform, monochrome, simplistic view. So you will have an assertion of triumph, but it's also worth drawing attention to the problems and deficiencies. So, for example, canals hit frequent problems in funding. Indeed, in his novel, Humphrey Clinker, Tobias Smollett observed the merchants of Glasgow have determined to make a navigable canal betwixt the two Forths, that's the Forth, the two Firths, the Firth of Clyde and the Firth of Forth, which will be of incredible advantage to their commerce in transporting merchandise from one side of the island to the other. Smollett, of course, was interested in that. He came from Clyde's side and he'd been back to Scotland. Yet, although it was approved in 1768, so 3 years before Smollett's novel was published, the Forth and Clyde Canal was left incomplete in 1775 due to a shortage of funds, and the 38-mile canal was only completed in 1790. Or again, the Glasgow-Paisley and Ardrossan Canal was proposed in 1791, begun in 1807, and opened, albeit not as far as Ardrossan, in 1811. And such delays sit alongside the interest in canals, such as Thomas Conder's The General History of Inland Navigation, 1795, which included a map surveyed by John Phillips, which demonstrated very clearly with the, it showed the canals completed and proposed, that in fact the canal network, whilst impressive in some areas, was sparse, fragmented, and especially limited, particularly in Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. So if we take Ireland, the Newry Navigation was built in Ireland in 1731 to 42. That was impressive. It linked Carlingford Lough with the River Banner at Portadown and opened up maritime links between Mid-Ulster and Dublin and took coal, in fact, to Dublin from East Tyrone. And this system was expanded when the Newry Ship Canal was finished in 1769, making Newry an important port. But it has to be said that although a number of other canals followed, the Strabane Canal, which was completed in 1796, or the Grand and Royal Canals, which linked Dublin and the Irish Midlands, much of Ireland, including in particularly southern and western Ireland, really did not benefit to any significant extent. In parts of England, the network was sparse. In some regions, such as Cumbria, the terrain limited the development of waterways. Bar an abortive attempt by George Dixon to construct a canal on Cotfield Fell in the 1760s, the northeast of England was scarcely affected. And after the failure of a short canal near St Austell in 1731, none was opened in the southwest of England until 1794. And these regions, in fact, were better served by the development of the turnpike system. I think it's worth saying that drawing attention simply to when things were opened might underrate interest in new links in the intervening period, and also that the sense of profitable change that was reflected or created. For example, Bevis Wood, the town clerk of Tiverton, recorded in 1768, and I shall quote from his papers, "A subscription is set on foot here to raise a sum of money to bring down Mr. Brindley," that's Mr. Brindley, the great canal man, "to take a survey of the country in order to make a navigable canal through part of Somerset and down by way of Taunton and Tiverton or Columpton to Exeter or Topsham. In other words, that would link Somerset to the sea, to the ports at both Exeter and Topsham. Subscriptions have also been opened for this purpose at Exeter, Columpton and Ufcombe and other parts of this neighbourhood. People in general, gentlemen and others, seem in earnest and to believe such a scheme very practicable and advantageous. This sense of advantage and of local and regional boosterism is very important to the canal system. The reliance on subscriptions for this survey reflected the voluntarist rather than governmental nature of local activism. But a canal craze or mania for opportunity did not hit much of the country till the 1790s. And this lack of governmental activism in part reflected the absence of an international example to follow. In Britain, most initiatives indeed were local as well as voluntary. There was no Ministry of Transport, of course, and the Crown did not use civil list money to seed corn canals, and no more was the government expected to do that. Apart from finance, there were other problems. Construction problems included the provision of an adequate water supply and preventing leaks. An adequate water supply was crucial because, of course, not so much that evaporation was an issue, though it was an issue, but more that it was difficult to seal canals. They were usually sealed with mud, but it was difficult to seal them. Incidentally, this is a problem with the canal near Tiverton at the moment, which is what remains from Bevis Wood's the project he was talking about. It's been losing water quite considerably for reasons that are unclear and therefore affecting the ability for pleasure craft to use it at the moment. So preventing leaks was an issue. Providing an adequate water supply, which meant reservoirs, was an issue. Steam engines did help. They helped in the development as they filled the reservoirs, pumping water into them, and wound the inclined planes. Inclined planes were devices for raising and lowering boats between different levels of a canal by hauling them up or down a ramp built for the purpose. In other words, an alternative to a lock. And these were used for the first time in England in 1788 on the Ketley Canal in Shropshire and were followed by the Shropshire Tubboat Canals. So they started then. As later with the railways, numerous canals that were planned were never completed and many other schemes were never even pursued. Others took much longer than had been intended or produced disappointing financial returns. And because of that, in a sense, although we tend to think in a sequential term, sense of canals being followed by railways, in practice, actually, there was a lot of canal construction in the early 19th century. We're going to turn to that, but first of all, I've been trying to talk about all aspects of water transport, and I want to say something about coastal transport in the late 18th century, because that's an element that tends again to be forgotten. And I think it's fair to say that the history of coastal transport in the British Isles as a whole tends to be forgotten, particularly in England, but also more generally. In practice, coastal trade was important for a whole series of local and regional economies, as well as for the aggregate national economy. It also grew with the developing economy of the 18th century, and notably, as before, with the transport of bulky goods. For example, Swansea, the area around Swansea, became the major centre in Britain for the smelting of copper. And indeed, it became a key centre in the world for the smelting of copper, and therefore very important for Britain's global economy and trade. The copper was brought to the works near Swansea from Cornwall, from Ireland, and from Anglesey, by sea, of course. In turn, Bristol received copper for smelting from Anglesey and Cornwall. It received China clay from Cornwall. It received iron, coal, and naval timber from the Forest of Dean, again by coastal trade. Ports were developed for exporting raw materials within the British Isles. So slate was dispatched from Snowdonia via Bangor, Carnarvon, and Port Penrhyn. Port Penrhyn was developed by Richard Pennant, the first Lord Penrhyn from the 1765. The east coast of England, where Captain James Cook acquired his nautical skills, was an important route, especially for the shipment of coal from Newcastle to London and to intermediate ports such as King's Lynn and Great Yarmouth. The average annual amount of coal shipped from the Tyne rose from just over 400,000 tonnes per annum in the 1660s to well over 600,000 by 1730 to 31, and to nearly 800,000 tonnes in the 1750s. 70% of this coal went to London in 1682, the coal being used obviously for heating to a great extent, but also for manufacturing, for soap building, for example, for glassworks. I mean, it was the basis of manufacturing in the London area, and London was an enormous centre of industry. And indeed, coal shipped to London remained crucial to its industrial basis into the 20th century. King's Lynn and Great Yarmouth took half of the rest of the coal. Companies that originated in the coal trade were in turn able to diversify into other aspects of shipping. So, for example, there's a recent history of Henley's of Wapping, which was a shipping company which had developed in the coal trade, and it added to that the role of a military shipping contractor. But other aspects, other things, were also shipped on the East Coast. For example, from the introduction of powdered ice in 1788, large quantities of salmon were shipped direct from Berwick-upon-Tweed to London. The Edinburgh Advertiser of the 17th of June 1783 noted the arrival in Leith, the port of Edinburgh, of six ships from Alnmouth, London, Wells and Yarmouth with grain. In turn, London continued to receive grain shipments from the southeast, for example, Margate, with Richard Gough noting in 1767, the harbour is pleasant but not adapted for large ships, yet great quantities of grain are shipped here for London. Prior to the 19th century, many places on the British coastline were in effect, at least in part, islands, due to the greater convenience of ship movements and the difficulties of those overland. Now, in terms of infrastructure, there was an important improvement in docks and harbour facilities that benefited this coastal trade, that benefited the interaction with the river and canal trade we've already talked about, and benefited the interaction with international trade. For example, an Act of Parliament of 1717 established the River Weir Commissioners in order to develop harbour facilities on the Lower Weir. That's the river that comes to the sea at Sunderland. In place of a hazardous anchorage made difficult and dangerous by rocks, sandbanks, the passage of a dangerous bar and exposure to northeasterly gales, came buoying, dredging, lighting, pier building, and controls over the dumping of ballast. The result was a much improved harbour entrance and a navigable channel that permitted a major growth in trade with the Weir and thus aided the development of Sunderland. This was an important example of what could be, and also the significance of a legislative framework. For example, another Act of Parliament of 1749 enabled the new Port Commission of Lancaster to develop St George's Quay, and this was followed by a customs house and the new quay. The Port Commission, in which, let's be clear, slave traders played an active role, also promoted Lancaster's representation in commercial issues of national importance. Glasgow suffered from the sandbanks in the Clyde estuary, but port facilities were developed at Port Glasgow on the Clyde estuary and later at Greenock, and these ensured that larger vehicles could be used. Now, economic activity benefited greatly from such responsive institutionalism, and it's interesting that Parliament found the time for this legislation. I mean, there were usually, you know, there was money behind private legislation, you know, fees had to be paid, etc., etc. But Parliament sat for far fewer days in the year, and you know, a lot of legislation was paid. It's worth bearing in mind that it operated within a competitive context, one in which rivalry and anxiety played a major role. So, for example, the Hull Dock Act of 1774 survived opposition from the town of Beverley, while in 1785, a committee was founded in Worcester to resist any parliamentary bill for tolls on the River Severn. Nevertheless, again, as I was saying about canals, alongside the emphasis on improved facilities for harbours, there was scant improvement in the condition of marine transport, which still remained heavily dependent on the weather. And indeed, the seasonal variation of insurance rates, which was brilliantly surveyed many years ago in a book produced by Frank Spooner, in which he mapped those in order to show how there were, as it were, equaliser lines of insurance rates and how these varied by season. The seasonal variation of insurance rates reflected the vulnerability of wind-powered wooden ships, which had not reached their mid-19th century standards of design efficiency and seaworthiness. By modern standards, they lacked deep keels, which made them fairly unpleasant and also reduced their carrying capacity. There could also be problems arising from a lack of safe procedures. So the Morning Post of 17th of March 1786 carried a report of an American ship running aground in Pembrokeshire. Quote, having lost her course in foggy weather owing to the negligence of the pilots who undertook to carry her to Milford Haven. For they were no sooner on board, but were invited by the captain to go down to the cabin where they continued drinking till the vessel was dashed against the rocks. Running aground wasn't much fun in this, it was never much fun, but was particularly not much fun in this period because most people could not swim. And most ships didn't carry sufficient small boats to actually enable them to get off safely. Wrecking, looting the cargoes of wrecked ships, and in some cases luring them to their destruction, were problems in parts of Cornwall, Wales, and Scotland. More generally, on the south and west coasts of Britain, strong southwesterly winds were a problem where shelter was absent or poor. This led to an emphasis on seawalls and local natural features, such as the cob, which survives at Lyme Regis and at a breakwater, which was strengthened several times between 1742 and 1826 in response to heavy storms. I mean, it remained a difficult place for Lyme Regis, but coastal trade continued there until the railway arrived. It was one of the later railways arriving in the beginning of the 20th century. Acting as a more general cost and thus economic constraint, sea travel was very slow compared with what it was to become the following century. But it was the cheapest method for the movement of goods and crucially important for bulk goods. And therefore, you cannot offer an account of transport in the period without discussing maritime links. And indeed, maritime links also brought together regions which today we often don't see as having much in common, such as southwest Scotland, Wigtown, Kirkcudbright, that sort of area, Stranraer, and Eastern Ireland. And in each case, road links to their hinterlands were poor, but the Irish Sea there and elsewhere formed an economic zone held together by maritime links based on major ports such as Belfast, Bristol, Dublin, Lancaster, Liverpool, Milford Haven, Wexford and Whitehaven, as well as now forgotten or tiny ports such as Parkgate in Wirral or Aberaeron or Bangor. These links provided crucial supplies. For example, Ireland's fuel shortage was met by coal from Cumbria and to a lesser extent, Ayrshire and Lancashire. Ireland didn't have much coal. It didn't have large pristine forests. And in fact, it was quite heavily dependent on coal being brought in. Lancashire iron ore was shipped to the blast furnaces of South Wales, while from Penarth, the harbour for nearby Cardiff, South Wales products as well as grain was exported. And this was part of a more general Bristol Channel trade, which included ports that we would now understand as ports, Swansea, for example, or Bristol, but places today that are not generally seen as ports of significance, economic significance, like Minehead or Watchet, were important in that period. They were both in Somerset, still are both in West Somerset. And also, these ports could benefit from related river links, as did, for example, Carmarthen, which exported woolen leather down the River Towy. And harbour improvements were seen in these areas as part and parcel of significance for the regional economy, though, for example, in Swansea in the 1760s. Coastal shipping lacked the profitability of foreign commerce, but if it had not taken place, I think it's fair to say that the foreign commerce would have found it much harder to draw on, on sufficient infrastructure. And the same, of course, with the benefit coming in from rivers and the benefit coming in from the canals. Now, what I think we'll do here is pause and we'll move on to the 19th century next time. But I want to give you, before we say one or two things, I want to give you a taster. And this comes from a novel that we should, The Old Curiosity Shop by Charles Dickens, comes out in 1841. And this, here's my quote. And it's obviously set in on the Thames. Coming slowly on through the forests of masts was a great steamship, beating the water in short, impatient strokes with her heavy paddles as though she wanted room to breathe, and advancing in her huge bulk like a sea monster among the minnows of the Thames. On either side were long black tiers of colliers, between them vessels slowly working out of harbour. The water and all upon it was in active motion, dancing and buoyant and bubbling upon. And this sense of change, of the power that steam was to bring to water transport, is something that I want to talk about next time. I just want to add something which I've only just thought of, and I'm sorry about this because I wrote a book on Dickens's Britain, but I've only just thought about it, that the image of the sea monster in the Old Curiosity Shop is rather like the image near the beginning of Bleak House of the dinosaur in London. Anyway, over to you, Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jeremy. I want to start by asking about how the, over the period of time, how the canals developed. Did they tend to start at the major maritime ports and then be cut their way through into the provinces? Or often were these provincial developments which were then cut in order to link up to maritime trade? Or is there no real pattern? Is it sometimes the one and sometimes the other?
Well, I think there's no real national pattern, as you correctly say, because there's individual enterprise between them. I think it's fair to say that canals were often devised in order, in the first instance, in order to try and deal with what were seen as deficiencies in the river system. Now, that could be very specific. We go right back, of course, I mentioned when we were talking about the Exeter Ship Canal in the Elizabethan period, that that's because the River Exe at that period had a very prominent weir, the Countess of Salisbury's weir, and the ship canal provided a regular route for ocean-going ships to reach Exeter. That's a little local canal. It's significant, but little and local. You then have the deficiencies of the absence of river links or the absence of deep rivers. So, for example, there is the Oxford Canal, which I've mentioned as a route between the Thames and Oxford, north via Banbury to the West Midlands, acted to deal with the absence of a river that was able to take that route. So I think it's fair to say that you had alternatives to rivers that were not up to it or not seen as up to it. But then you also get blue sky canals, as is to happen, of course, with railways. And those are often for very specific economic purposes. I suppose you could argue that the Bridgewater Canal between Liverpool and Manchester falls into that category. They could be, as with the Louth Canal in Lincolnshire, designed to provide a better dig between a port and the sea, which was consequential. They could be designed, as I think I was talking about with the Sapperton Canal. The Thames and Severn Canal was built through Gloucestershire across the Cotswolds in 1783-7. That's the one which has the Sapperton tunnel in. And that involved 44 locks. Now, that in a sense was defying geography or defying the terrain because you were having to get across the Cotswolds. So that canals, rather like Roman roads, could ultimately, through tunnels and through locks, try and cross areas between river basins, which generally meant crossing higher terrain.
And that's an interesting, just to pick you up on the last point, that's an interesting angle, the use of tunnelling. In the second half of the 18th century, how far really can the technology take a tunnel for canal purposes?
Well, I mean, it can. I mean, it's hard work. What you have to do is use a combination of navvies and, in a sense, the hard work done in the 19th century with the railways is prefigured by the hard work done with the canals. And you use gunpowder. And so you would classically use your sort of picks and shovels to try and bash holes in which you would put gunpowder. You would then blow the gunpowder with no sense of what we would today call health and safety. And you would try and then gradually extend. It would take several years. I have to say, now that we're more used to the delays of most modern projects, I think we should be less censorious about the time it could take for projects in the 18th century. They didn't have the high explosive that you get in the late 19th century, thanks to people like Mr. Nobel. So, you know, things like nitroglycerine and gelignite aren't there, and dynamite. And gunpowder is not as efficient by any means, and in terms of either the capacity to use it or the explosive force it gives off. Nevertheless, so you weren't going to use gunpowder to dig a tunnel under the Alps. Nevertheless, you could use it, and they did use it to get through the Cotswolds. I mean, there's no reason for you to have seen it. But in the mid-20-teens, I did a television programme for BBC on the Industrial Revolution, and part of it involved some shooting of a passage in which we went through a canal tunnel in the West Midlands, and it was a long tunnel, and it was an impressive one. There's no two ways about it. And obviously, it was dug by hand and with the use of gunpowder, so they could do it, yep.
Well, I have seen that documentary, as it happens. Where there aren't these enormous geographical issues, you're cutting through hills and so on, what is the rate of progress in constructing a canal? How rapidly, how many miles could be typically cut in a year's work?
Well, I mean, that's... I mean, I've just given you for the Thames and Severn. I think the point is it's a question really of how many people you want to use and can you afford to work at it from both ends? That's absolutely crucial. So are you going to use essentially one gang or two gangs, one work gang or two work gangs? And are you at the same time going to be digging out the reservoirs to supply the water? In fact, do you need to dig out reservoirs? How plentiful is the local water supply or not? But, I mean, I think I gave you the figures of essentially 4 or 5 years for the 19 miles of what was a difficult canal linking the Thames and the Severn. At the same time, that was a canal on which a lot of work was taken. I think we also looked, do you recall, We mentioned the canal between the Firth of Forth and the Firth of Clyde, and that was much slower. But then that was because, not because it was a harder task, in some respects, it was an easier task, but because it was, there was a shortage of money. So they began it in 1768. It's 38 miles long, and they only finished it in 1790. But they weren't digging it all the time. So I think a lot of it depends upon the persistence of it. The Newry navigation took 11 years, but again, they weren't digging it all the time. If you look at the Irish ones, so the Grand Canal, which was built between 1756 and 1805, that's a very long time. And the Royal Canal, 1789 and 1817. But then what you should say rather is these are putting together the fact that different bits are built at different system at times, and then people suddenly decide, well, let's all link them all together, which indeed is what happened with quite a few railways subsequently, and indeed what happened with quite a few turnpikes. You might decide, I suppose you could say, how long did it take to build the M1? And the answer is, well, when they initially set out to build the M1, they weren't trying to build a motorway to Leeds. And a lot of it does depend upon the way in which people subsequently expand their intentions, and actually that roads often, or railways or canals, often link together partly new construction and partly construction that had already taken place for a different purpose.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, we'll have to leave it there. Next time we'll be talking about waterways, canals, and both the competition with the railways, and also the way in which they interconnected and supported one another cooperatively. But for talking us through the second half of the 18th century and the construction of canals and their link to maritime trade as well, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.